This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Today's Jazz Beat focuses on a celebrated encounter between Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. Armstrong and Duke Ellington recorded only one album together, and it was a long time in coming. The Great Summit was made for Roulette Records in 1961, decades after these giants of jazz had come to prominence in the 20s, and several years after George Avakian proposed such a meeting for Columbia Records in 1955. Avakian had been the producer of two concept albums that Armstrong made in the mid-50s, Louis Armstrong Plays W.C. Handy, and its successor, Satch Plays Fats. Both were critical and commercial successes. The Handy album, which was recorded with the father of the blues himself in the studio, may be the finest album by Armstrong's All-Stars, the name he gave the succession of small groups he worked with after disbanding his orchestra in 1947. Avakian also produced Armstrong's hit recording of Mack the Knife, and he helped define the late-career Armstrong legend with an album of European concert performances entitled Ambassador Satch. A New Yorker cartoon from the period shows a group of political leaders holding a strategy session, with one of them asking, "Should we send Secretary of State John Foster Dulles or Louis Armstrong?" Avakian's ultimate wish for Armstrong was to showcase the trumpeter with the orchestra of his one true peer, Duke Ellington. Both were receptive to the idea, but by the time it was proposed, Armstrong's Columbia contract had expired, and his manager, Joe Glazer, threw a wrench in the works when, instead of agreeing to a contract extension, he insisted that Avakian put his proposal on paper. Glazer was a notoriously tough agent whose primary considerations were first, last, and always his, and his number one client's financial security.
Off in Harlem, yeah, good old Harlem. You have your fun under the Harlem sun, so drop me off in Harlem. There's Duke Ellington up in Harlem. He writes all his tunes in Harlem, and old Satchmo's still swinging way up in Harlem.
Ellington grouped Glazer and Armstrong in his autobiography, Music Is My Mistress, and wrote, perhaps with a little envy, "Then you realize that in spite of how well Joe Glazer did for himself, Louis still ended up a very rich man, maybe the richest of all the trumpet Gabriels. This is not a fact to be ignored, for what more can one man do for another? Joe watched over Louis like the treasure he was, and saw to it that his partner was well fixed for the rest of his life. He didn't really have to work, but the fact that he did showed how it is when a musician is married to his horn. Louis Armstrong was the epitome of jazz, and always will be. He was also a living monument to the magnificent career of Joe Glazer." Glazer's M.O. meant something different to George Avakian, who 50 years later offered this recollection to Armstrong biographer Terry Teachout. I didn't trust Joe not to take my ideas to another label for more money than Columbia was offering. I decided that I didn't want to go into it like that. So Avakian abandoned the idea and continued his estimable work with Dave Brubeck, Miles Davis, the Ellington Orchestra, and later with Paul Desmond and Sonny Rollins. In 1959 and 60, Armstrong and Ellington crossed paths on a couple of occasions, including the Paul Newman-Sidney Poitier movie Paris Blues, in which Armstrong's character, Wild Man Moore, plays the Ellington numbers Battle Royal and Wild Man. Duke spent 3 weeks in Paris composing music for the film and hanging out. He described the break from concertizing as the closest thing to a vacation he'd ever taken. Closer to George Avakian's ideal, Lewis was heard, albeit briefly, playing Perdido with the Ellington Orchestra over the closing credits of a Timex All-Star Jazz Show television special in 1959. Otherwise, Armstrong had recorded surprisingly few Ellington tunes over the years. These included a superb treatment of In My Solitude in 1935, and in 1957 he recorded Don't Get Around Much Anymore and Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. Nonetheless, Ellington's English-born chronicler, Stanley Dance, who was at the sessions, said Armstrong was so quick to grasp the whole concept of an interpretation, and on several numbers, he seemed to know the Ellington routines better than Barney Bigard. The New Orleans-born clarinetist Barney Bigard had spent 15 years with Duke before joining Armstrong in 1944, and Sea Jam Blues, which was reborn as Duke's Place on the Great Summit, had been a feature for Bigard during his many years with Armstrong. Of this VSOP encounter, Bigard said, the main thing was that Lewis got along so great with Duke. Two prominent leaders on one date could have been rough, but we had no problems.
Baby, take me down to Duke's place. Wildest box in town is Duke's place. Love that piano sound in Duke's place. Saxes do their tricks in Duke's place. Fellas swing their chicks in Duke's place. Come on, get your kicks in Duke's place. Take it, Duke.
Bob Thiel, who produced The Great Summit and co-wrote the lyric for Duke's Place, had been a record company executive since the early 40s, working with a wide array of jazz and pop artists, including Coleman Hawkins, Errol Garner, Buddy Holly, and Pat Boone. Soon after this date, he founded Impulse Records, the iconic jazz label synonymous with John Coltrane, and a roster of artists that ranged from avant-gardists Archie Shepp and Pharoah Sanders to the mainstream icons Pee Wee Russell and Johnny Hodges. For the Great Summit, it was decided that Duke would sit in with Armstrong's All-Stars on a program devoted exclusively to Ellington's songs, 17 in total, recorded over 2 days, April 3rd and 4th, 1961. He introduced two new tunes at the date, an up-tempo blues titled The Beautiful American and Azalea, a ballad he had attempted to record twice before with other singers. Ellington's lyric was inspired by the way Armstrong wrote about the gardens of his native New Orleans in his first memoir, Swing That Music. Jazz historian Dan Morgenstern was present at the session and wrote about how quickly and effectively each tune took shape for effective performance. He credited Armstrong with being one of the quickest studies to ever set foot in a studio. Azalea was the session's biggest surprise, and Morgenstern, who directed the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers for many years, was especially impressed with how Lewis handled it. He said, Duke mustered up the courage to dig out a lead sheet for Azalea. He pulled up a chair, sat down facing Lewis, and held up the words and music. Lewis donned his glasses, smiled that matchless smile, and began to hum and sing. An expert sight reader, he soon had the melody down. As all this was taking shape, Ellington was positively beaming, and when a take had been made, he was ecstatic. If indeed he had had Lewis in mind when he created Azalea, he had chosen properly. ¶¶
was such a fine spring day down Louisiana way, with fragrance divine, oh baby, and such magnificent regalia, oh so fine, azalea. Oh, what a lovely sight, in red and pink and white. Can't help but believe that nothing evil can assail you so naive. Azalea, you at ease on the knees of the moss-covered trees, whose tops met to make on high, ceiling in the church-like pump of a cypress swamp. I've yet to get that same strange feeling. I've got to go back there and find that blossom fair I'll always dream of. 'Cause with you, who could be a failure? My first love, Azalea.
Armstrong digs into the rest of this set of Ellington standards with relish. In Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life, Lawrence Berggreen wrote, he treated every syllable and note as if it contained essential truths. Louis wrings deep feeling from The Mooch, I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good, and Mood Indigo. The latter, co-composed by Duke and Barnaby Guard, became a part of Armstrong's repertoire for the last decade of his career. Louis also managed a magisterial two-chorus solo on Black and Tan Fantasy, the Ellington classic with strains of Chopin's Funeral March that was introduced during Duke's Cotton Club years in the late 20s. In his Ellington biography, Beyond Category, John Edward Haas noted that over the course of his three-year-long engagement at the famed Harlem nightclub, Ellington had taken a position equal to Louis Armstrong as the leading figure in jazz. Armstrong, the greatest soloist, Ellington, the greatest bandleader and composer. Thank you. In Ellington's vast discography, his rendition of I'm Just a Lucky So-and-So with Armstrong offers a unique example of Duke playing behind a singer without additional ensemble backing. Anyone doubting Ellington's genius as a pianist should pay attention to the penetrating touch, propulsive chords, and imaginative backgrounds that are so prominent here and throughout the Great Summit. As Stanley Dance wrote, the pianist's part in this performance is exemplary. Duke's surpassing ability as an accompanist should be studied and enjoyed, for it is even more readily apparent in this context than it is with his own band. Dance's English compatriots, Max Jones and John Chilton, agreed, albeit more succinctly. In saluting Armstrong in their biography, The Louis Armstrong Story, they praised the trumpeter's performance as testimony to his continued greatness, then added, the pianist is no slouch either.
As I walk down the street, seems everyone I meet gives me a friendly hello. I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so.
The Great Summit is generally regarded as the last great album-length performance by Armstrong, whose trumpet chops declined throughout the 60s. Nonetheless, his singing and larger-than-life persona remain prominent, and two more big hits lay ahead, Hello Dolly in 1964 and What a Wonderful World in 1968. The latter, co-written and produced by Bob Thiel, may stand today as the best-known of Armstrong's records. Ironically, as Ricky Riccardi relates in What a Wonderful World, the magic of Louis Armstrong's later years, while the song was being recorded, a nasty dispute was being played out in the studio between Thiel and ABC Paramount President Larry Newton, who questioned its commercial viability. Ellington's career continued to flourish over the next decade as he and Billy Strayhorn collaborated on additional suites and commission works, and Duke played command performances, earned honorary degrees, the keys to cities, and was feted with a 70th birthday party at the White House. One of his most celebrated late career works was the New Orleans Suite, which included the portrait of Louis Armstrong. The trumpeter's influence was long reflected not only in the work of Ellington trumpeters Cootie Williams, Freddie Jenkins, Ray Nance, and several others, but on trombonist Lawrence Brown, and on the greatest Ellingtonian, saxophonist Johnny Hodges, who credited Armstrong with his approach to rhythm and emotional expressiveness. Duke's total portrait of Armstrong was revived 25 years ago by Wynton Marsalis and Jazz at Lincoln Center. For its premiere, it featured Cootie Williams, who'd first joined Ellington in 1929. Here he is 41 years later. Reflecting on the Great Summit, Dan Morgenstern wrote, "The easy, warm rapport between these two great artists, their understanding of each other's needs, their mixing of high seriousness and frivolous banter, were a unique personification of jazz at its warmest and tightest. It was a joy to be there, and a wonder to reflect on and bask in the youthful presence and spirit of these two men, both in their seventh decade of life, still finding challenges and discovering joy in their work." Louis Armstrong died in 1971, Duke Ellington in 1974. Between the two, Armstrong has been the more unsullied figure in historical treatments and biographies. Even the scepter of Uncle Tom that shadowed the outsized Satchmo during his career has faded. But Ellington is increasingly cast as manipulative in his personal and professional relationships and deceptive in his assignment of lucrative composer credits with sidemen and colleagues, especially Billy Strayhorn. I'm wary of what may be ulterior motives in some of Ellington's accusers and detractors, and I recognize that Duke's undertakings and collaborations were much larger and more complex than Armstrong's. But one could hardly ask for a more moving eulogy, nor one that might be read today as an unwitting self-revelation, than the one Duke paid Lewis. At the conclusion of his tribute to Armstrong in Music Is My Mistress, Ellington wrote, "I loved and respected Louis Armstrong. He was born poor, died rich, and never hurt anyone on the way." For additional features on Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington, including my recent selection of 10 Desert Island Essentials of Armstrong Recordings, Azalea is number 10, visit the Jazz on the Mode blog at NEPR.net. If you'd like to tell me your Armstrong favorites, drop me a line at tr@NEPR.net. Thanks to Katie Wright for production assistance. For Jazz Beats, I'm Tom Reeney.
Get away, Duke, get away, yeah.